All right, good morning to everyone. We'll be starting our class today momentarily. We're continuing with Noahide laws. Today we'll continue with a question we left from last week regarding mixed breeding of species. And we'll talk about the philosophy of it a bit, why it's one of the seven Noahide laws, and also what the difference is between a Noahide infringement as well as an Israelite infringement. And we will start in just about 2 minutes. Part of the class, we do record these sessions and they put on our audio page or also on the new posting section of the Masorah website. So you'll be able to listen to it in its entirety from there if you join late or if you miss any part of it. Now we'll just start in a moment. Doug, how are you today?
I'm good, thank you.
Sure. Cal's there?
He will be here in just a moment.
Okay. So we had that the question from last week.
Bill. Morning, Bill. Hey, good morning. This is Doug?
Yeah. Hey, how you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Good.
Good. How's Cal, kids? Everybody okay?
I'm right here. Good morning.
Everyone's well. Oh, that's good. Rabbi, you were talking about a question from last week.
Right. We left with a question regarding Noah Hyde law of mixed breeding. We had touched on it in the past in terms of why it is considered one of the Noah Hyde laws. Right, of all the laws you have, it seems to be a little bit out of place. We understand idolatry and adultery and stealing, but how does mixed breeding come into the picture? And we had touched on, we went to depth into one aspect of it, because we saw that we had the question of why castration of animals is something which is a lower form of the mixed breeding. It would seem to be the mixed breeding on the surface is a distortion of God's intended species. So if that's really the crime, it would seem to be a termination of the species would be even worse. So that would seem to have more primary place. But what we said was, do you remember the discussion?
I'm a little confused. When you talk about termination of the species, you talk about a single animal or you talk about a whole species?
Well, that again, if you just you violate, when you do castration of an animal, so it would just be that specific line, of course. You're not going to terminate the whole species, but it partakes of it. You are diminishing that species, in a quantitative measure.
Okay.
So even though you're not eliminating the entire species, nonetheless, it does partake of the same quality. In as much as you're involved in that category of corruption, so somebody who destroys the whole species would definitely violate to an extreme, where somebody who just castrates one, one cat. So of course, it's a marginal type of a limitation of the species, but in terms of the quality, he's definitely involved in that very same quality of action. Right? We can see that.
Yep.
Okay. So initially we talked about if that's true, and that's something that seems to be derived, the Gemara has one of the views, that is Rabbi Chitka seems to be deriving it from the prohibition of mixed breeding. What he seems to get from that is also that we can derive from there that castration would be something that would be prohibited.
Then extrapolate the limb of the living animal from that?
No.
Or he's extrapolating castration as a separate law?
Yeah, let me see. I'm sorry, I was talking about the wrong thing. Not from mixed breeding, right, from what you just said, from Avram and Ahai, from the limb, from taking a limb of a living animal. So, from there, he says, it appears to me, because it's on the same statement where it says the list of the seven Noahide laws. So eating a limb from a living animal is the last one in the list. And then Rabbi Hananya says even having the blood, even ingesting the blood from a living animal will be a problem, which is clearly a derivative of eating the limb, right? And Rav Chidcha comes in and he says, even on castration. So the words even mean to say we can even derive, meaning from this area of eating a limb from a living animal, we can not only derive eating the blood is prohibited, but we can add another prohibition, and that is castration. So we were, when you look at the prohibition of eating a limb, so you're treating the species a certain way. So you might think that castration is is the most severe way of related to the species, right? Because then you're terminating it, at least this line or this specific one. So why would castration be a derivative? It would seem to me that should really be the head of the category. So why is it really that taking the limb is really the head of the category? So we discussed this once, and what we said is that Rashi actually spells it out. He says that, you know, it's on a later statement of the Gemara, of the Talmud, but when they ask the question, where do you derive all these seven laws from, and they give the one verse in Genesis, so he says, from the words, when God tells Adam, from all the trees of the garden, you can surely eat. So the words there is achol tochol. A double language is in Hebrew, it means to stress. So achol tochol, the word achol means to eat. So when God says to Adam, achol tochol, so you can certainly eat, so then Rashi makes it, he teaches what the Gemara's derivation is. And he says, these things stand for man as food. But you cannot eat a limb from an animal. Because an animal, in it, while it's yet alive, is not in the capacity of food, but it's in the capacity of procreating. That's the whole Rashi statement. So he's trying to indicate a little bit more of an understanding as to why eating the limb of a living animal, what the problem is. So he says, an animal, when it's alive, you can't just take a limb off of it and eat it. And actually, last month, somebody told me, this person lives in Japan, and evidently they've got some, their ideas of robbery and theft or crime is much different. Somebody had, they were trying to steal a cow, and they couldn't do it, so they just took off like a limb of the cow. So evidently, they needed food. So they were going to take the whole cow and probably eat some, sell some, whatever, but they couldn't move it or whatever it was. So they actually violated this very prohibition of taking the limb from the animal. And they had to kill the animal, of course, to put it out of its pain. But you see that this is something which is very well within man's capability even today. It shows you the design of the human being has not changed. So what is Rashi saying? That an animal in its life is really to be for procreation. It's not fit for food when it's still alive. What's Rashi's message?
Well, he's defining a certain state in which you can eat an animal and which you cannot. And he's clearly delineating that as when it's alive, it's not in an appropriate halakhic state to be considered as food, but when it's dead, it is.
Okay, so what's the underlying prohibition then? I mean, it's just a matter of knowing when you can eat something or not. That has to be one of the seven Noahide laws. There's got to be more of a primary message here for something to really be qualified and be up there.
I would say the message is that it has to do with having an appropriate permit. I mean, everything belongs to God. And so you don't have a permit to eat an animal unless it's been given to you. And the only permit that's been given to man to eat animals is when they're in a dead state, not when they're in a live state. So the underlying message has to do, I think, with God's ownership of the universe and that he establishes the rules for when you can do something and when you can't.
Right, very good. Good. Meaning to say God's will. That what you're doing, the violation that one is committing, is that, like Rashi's stating that the animal is not in that status of food while it's alive, but it's in the status of procreating. Now, where does that status come from? So you have to take Rashi's words and understand what his underlying message is. And like you're saying, that it doesn't have that capacity, and it's really from the creator who designates what role something plays. So that means the underlying message is God's will. And what I suggested a few weeks ago when we were discussing this is that the reason why the head category is not castration, because that would seem to be a clear case of where you're going against God's will. You're now saying this animal is not for procreation. So if I castrate it, isn't that the most open violation of God's will for this animal? It would seem to be. But then a person might think that that is the whole prohibition. It's just the castration. But anything else would be all right. So I think the reasoning why really the Noahide law is in terms of eating and taking the limb from the animal, because that is showing how you're going against what the role of this animal is right now. It's not food. Right now it doesn't have the capacity. It has a different role. So it's not as drastic as the termination that comes about when you castrate the animal, because the animal still can procreate even if you took a limb off of it. But it points more towards going against God's will, because that's what I believe the concept of taking a limb from an animal is trying to drive home. Meaning, why is it so primary? I understand all the other seven Noahide laws. I mean, setting up courts and rejecting idolatry and accepting God. And the family unit, you know, adultery and stealing. Those I understand, but then you have something which seems a little bit peripheral. It's like, you know, if you throw in wearing tzitzis into the seven Noahide laws, it doesn't seem to have the same priority, the same place, the same primary status as these other ones. But if we see that the idea is really that you should not go against God's will, that's primary. Now we can appreciate why this law is included in the seven Noahide laws. Similar to what we were talking about last week about how there were three views about whether Adam the first had only the prohibition of idolatry, or did he also have the prohibition of not cursing, or did he also have the obligation of courts. Right. All right. Now, give me 1 second. Meaning to say, what we were discussing last week is that these were derivatives, that if man, according to Rabbi Yehuda, was only given, the Talmud says, Rabbi Judah states, Adam the first was not commanded except on idolatry alone. That's it. So what we said last week was that it was God's will that he would now use his mind, Adam would use his mind and work out his life based on wisdom, because that was God's original plan. The man should just have this, he needed to have one command to let him know the relationship between him and God, that God is the ruler and we are the servant. Now once we have that one command that teaches that relationship, now we can work out the rest, and that's what God wanted. That's what he gave Adam the first, a tremendously wise mind and with a complete intelligence. Because it was God's will that he would then use his intelligence and live his life based on making his own durations, induction and deduction. That would be how he would arrive at new truths. He wanted man to uncover the layers the layers of an onion, to constantly be peeling back and seeing more and more by constantly engaging the mind to do it. If everything is just presented, here's everything you have to do, the mind is not engaged. And much more can be discovered by using reason than just reading a discrete amount of text in a book. I don't care how big the book is. But when you have a system where there's so many, like with the Torah that we have, and so, you know, there's so many nuances and ways and methods of rational thought, you can derive so much more than just the written text because of the way wisdom is designed by God. So that's what he wanted from Adam. So then he was able to, you know, come to an understanding that what God's will is. So since God's will is a primary concept in terms of how we're supposed to live our lives, so therefore it has to be one of the seven Noahides. That's why you have Abram and Ichai. That's why you have the prohibition of eating the limb. To teach you a very simple example, do not treat this animal other than God's will. Right now it's not food. When it's dead, it's food. Then you can treat it like food. Right now it's a living being. It's for procreation. So recognize and follow a lifestyle where you admit to God's will, and that is reality. Evidently, there's a desire in man to combat that, to violate the will of God and to live by his own will. That's the danger of having, you know, free will, but the benefits greatly outweigh the dangers. And if we guide the free will that we have based on reason and what we observe in the universe, and we see that we are created, that means that that lesson itself should teach us that we are put here, and it's not our own doing that we are here. So whose doing is it? So that lesson right then and there should really catapult a person into the realm of thought, where he feels a sense of appreciation and gratitude for having been created, and that will help him to combat these feelings of violating God's will. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Now, we left with a question last week. We're moving on to a statement of Rabbi Eliezer. So Rabbi Eliezer says as follows. And this again, we're in 56b in Sanhedrin. It's just about maybe a fifth of the way down in the page. And he says that Ben Noach is commanded on mixed breeding of species. Okay. But he qualifies the statement. He says, a Ben Noach is permitted to wear mixed breeds of linen and wool, for example, which a Jew cannot do. A Ben Noach is also, a Noachide is also allowed to plant mixed seeds. Again, something which a Jew cannot do, an Israelite cannot do. And the Noahide is not prohibited, except in what aspects of mixed breeding? With crossbreeding animals, which would appear to be where he causes one animal to inseminate an animal of a different species. And the second type of prohibition is to graft a branch of one tree, let's say an apple branch, onto an orange tree. Okay. It seems kind of arbitrary. We see that Quinter Belezer, he says that even on the Ben Noach has a prohibition even on mixed breeding, which is really not one of the seven that were listed before. But again, we have different views in the Talmud, and our objective really is just to understand the theory right now. What is his theory? But in his theory of mixed breeding, it's not a duplicate of what the Jew is prohibited on. A Jew is not allowed to wear wool and linen clothing. Even though these things are detached from their source of nutrients, the wool is sheared from the animal, from the the sheep, and the but a Jew is prohibited in that, and a Ben Noach is not. You could wear wool and linen clothing together. A Jew is also prohibited to take an apple seed and an orange seed and plant them together. That also a Noahide is allowed to do. But what is it that the Noahide cannot do when it comes to mixed breeding? He can't crossbreed species of animals, and he can't graft branches from one tree onto another tree of a different species. Question is, what is the reason for this distinction between the first two things that a Ben Noach can do, and the second that he can't, whereas a Jew can't do any of them? I mean, it seems to be it's much more intuitive to follow the prohibition for the Jew. All types of mixed breeding would be prohibited. Just like a Jew, why is it that the Ben Noach has a, there's a distinction in the prohibition of mixed breeding? A Jew can't wear any wool linen clothing. He can't take seeds of an orange seed and an apple seed, he cannot take and put in the ground. And the Jew cannot take a tree branch and graft it onto another tree of a different species. And the Jew can't take a horse and try to cause it to procreate with a lamb, whatever. So why is it the Jew has all, across the board, he has got all of these prohibitions in terms of mixed breeding? When it comes to a Noahide, Noahide, no. He can wear wool and linen, he can put seeds in the ground of different species, but his prohibition, that's only in terms of taking a tree branch from an apple tree and grafting it onto an orange tree, or taking two diverse species of animals and causing them to copulate. So this is the question. Is the question clear?
Yes, although I have one technical question. When it talks about planting seeds in the ground, we're just talking about taking an apple seed and an orange seed, for example, and sticking them in the ground near each other?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. Right. So it's interesting. What we have to do now is to try to understand the distinction as meaning in the, you know, the Torah has 613 laws. And one of them is to mix species, to mix breed. We're not allowed to change the species. And Ramban, he talks about this. You're going against God's will, clearly. God set up the world to have certain type of species. And it's a denial in terms of God regarding his role as creator as well. So it's a severe violation. And to observe this is a very important thing. By the way, Ibn Ezra, Rabbi Chait, had given a class, a very nice class years ago, and he spoke about just the concept in general of mixed breeding. And we have it in a number of areas. And like, for example, you can't work two animals together in the field. And you can't mix certain seeds. And you can't wear wool and linen in your clothing. So Ibn Ezra had made a statement, and he's on this concept. It's called shatnez. Shatnez is the term applied to these different forms of mixing. So Ibn Ezra is trying to explain what's the reason for it. What is the primary lesson over here? Aside from what Ramban said, that you're going against God as being creator, but Ibn Ezra states a very enigmatic. He makes a very enigmatic statement, and he says, you know, he refers you to a different commentary that he has. So if you go back to that commentary, so he says that the shatness is really this concept of not mixing is to be a remembrance of the two things that are planted in the heart. He says the reason why you can't mix species is really to recall the two things that you should not mix in your human heart. What is he talking about? What are the two things that a person should not mix in his heart? So Rabbi Chait explained that the two things you're not supposed to mix in your heart are your intelligence and your emotions. You're not, if you're to live the correct life, all your decisions, and Rabbi Mann had mentioned this recently, he was talking about how a prophet or a very high-level person, all his decisions in life are always guided by his intelligence, his reason. He never makes a decision because of an emotional impulse or some need, a feeling. So that's the type of person, when a person, his intelligence rules over his emotions. And a human being has that capacity. That's how God designed us. He didn't tell us to follow our intelligence if it's impossible. No, God told us to follow our intelligence because we can get to the point where our convictions and what our mind tells us is true is more powerful than the emotional pull we have. Even though our emotions have a head start over our intelligence, like it says in when God smelled the sacrifice that Noah offered after the flood. And so now God makes a statement, And he said he smelled the sweet savor of the sacrifice that Noah had sacrificed after the whole flood was over, after the land dried, and Noah came out of the ark, and he offered a sacrifice to God. So God, so to speak, he smelled it, meaning he recognized it, and he said he will not ever again cause a flood. Why? Because the inclination of man is evil from youth. So that sounds like a condemning statement. But God's saying, no, this is the reason why I won't have to destroy man anymore. Because man's inclination is only evil from youth, meaning the inclination of man, the instincts, have a head start on the intelligence. That's why a child is not considered obligated in mitzvah until he's 13 or so. Because that's really when the mind starts to develop and he can be responsible for his actions. But prior to that point, it's funny, my friend would refer to his children when they were very young. He says they're just little animals. he said in a loving way, but he was saying, listen, they're just a bunch of evil instincts running around. You can't, you know, there's no intelligence yet. So all they're doing is chasing after what's satisfying them. So you see that even though the emotions have a head start, nonetheless, the intelligence is stronger because the intelligence can perceive things that are 100% clear and the person can attach himself to them and he's not convinced any further by just what feels good because the mind has the ability to overpower the emotions. So the Ibn Ezra's point is that he wants to say the reason why you have this concept of not mixing the species in so many different areas, his point is because it has to, you need it in so many parts of your life, whether you're working animals in the field, whether you're wearing clothing, whether you're planting, whatever it is, there are many areas during the day where God saw fit that you should have reminders of not to mix two things that are in your heart. So Ibn Ezra alludes to that. And yes, go ahead.
Rabbi, the question is then if a Noahide is not doesn't fall under the same prohibitions regarding shotness of the Jew does, and taking Ibn Ezra's, I guess, deeper meaning, does that suggest then that a Noahide, since he is not obligated to shotness, he can mix, so is taking your example or Ibn Ezra's example of the emotions and the intellect, then a Noahide is not forbidden from mixing the two, correct?
He is. They're only. But he has a lesser form. The Noahide has two areas that he cannot mix. What we were saying before, that even though there's basically four cases that the Talmud brings down. The four cases are mixing wool and linen in your clothing. Number two is planting diverse seeds. Number three is grafting one tree branch onto another tree. And number four is crossbreeding animals. The last two, the Noahide is obligated to follow. So he does partake of that category of not mixing things in his mind, just like a Jew. Not mixing things in his heart. He's not...
The latter two, if it's applied to a Noahide, then by extension, can the analogy that Ibn Ezra uses also apply in that regard to a Noahide then?
Of course.
The example, correct. So it would be not mixing emotions and intellect.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
For sure. I mean, Rabbi Cheda had said, this past year I was discussing this area with Rabbi Cheda and Rabbi Mann. Actually I was discussing with Rabbi Mann, but he was quoting Rabbi Cheda. And he was saying that anything that has to do with perfection, a Noahide would have to follow. So when you have the commands, there are seven commands, but there's actually more. I think, Doug, you'd mentioned something like 60 or 66. When really, you know, if you really go into it, you see that it really has, there's like Torah and Shabbos. There's many things that are not under the formal seven. But aside from commands, then there's like areas of perfection and the different ways that the patriarchs and the matriarchs lived. So anything which has to do with perfection, that's something which is equal. No hiding Jew.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, so we come back to our question. So now we have a little bit of the philosophy of the mixed breeding. We understand how, according to Ramban, we're not going to violate God as creator by trying to mix diverse species, because we're recognizing God's will that these species should be intact and they shouldn't be diluted. But the question is, why is it that a Noahide can wear wool and linen, he can plant the seeds,
when it comes to the tree and the animal there, he can't graft the branch of an apple tree onto an orange tree, for example, and he also can't take one animal species and cause it to copulate with another one. That he can't do. So let's just understand what the distinction is. That's the question we have now. Trees and animals, he can't crossbreed. But two seeds in the ground, or wearing wool and linen on his clothing, that he can do. So let's think about what the distinction is.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Well, I want to suggest that the distinction is that the Noahide is allowed to use those things that God has created in whatever way he wishes, but he's not allowed to create something new. And the grafting of a tree or the crossbreeding of an animal creates something new.
What about
wearing linen and wool together or planting two seeds together does not create something new.
Planting two seeds together, that doesn't create something new?
Not a new species. I mean, if I put an apple tree and an orange tree seed in the ground nearby, I'm going to get two trees close by, one's apples, one's oranges.
No, that's not true, because if that was the case, there would be no problem for the Jew to do it either. If there's really not going to be any chance of the species mixing, so why is there, are you telling me from fact that it doesn't work that way?
I'm assuming from fact that it doesn't work that way. If you're going to tell me that that's different, then that changes the fact.
Well, I've never done the test. And nor do I have any, sources on that. My assumption is just that if they're that close, there's a chance of them actually crossbreeding and creating some sort of a new species. I mean, if they're both, let's say they put a seed of an apple and an orange in the ground. Well, that's a good question. The question is really where's the growth going to come from? Evidently, if you put a tree branch into another tree, so now it's now growing off the apple tree branch that I stuck into the trunk of an orange tree. So the apple tree branch is now gaining sustenance from the orange tree. So clearly there's going to be an intermingling there. If the two seeds stay isolated completely and they just create two trees, even though they're very close, there could be. So you're saying if that's true, so then you're right. So then it's just the creation of the new species which is the problem. And that only happens when you graft and when you crossbreed.
So Rabbi, could it have something to do with the level of growth or maturity or potentiality of the two items or the several items we're talking about here? In other words, you have, in one case you have a fully developed organism like a tree or an animal, as opposed to something that hasn't begun to reach any potential. Does that have anything to do with it?
What do you mean? The two seeds in the ground?
Yeah. In other words, they haven't germinated yet. They haven't reached any kind of potential or maturity. While on the other hand, a fully developed tree, for instance, or a fully developed animal has already reached a certain level of consciousness, I guess, if you want to call it that, a certain, awareness of its existence. I know that's pretty esoteric, I hope I'm probably not...
I hear what you're saying. You're saying that, it's an interesting idea where you're going. You're saying that there's nothing really, it's dormant. The seeds are dormant.
Yeah, correct. I mean, there's no real life in the seeds when you put them in the ground, and until they get together and begin the process of germination, there's really no life force.
Uh-huh.
But once the animal is fully developed or the tree is fully developed, it already has reached its full potential. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Right, so, just it sounds like you're building on top of what Doug said then.
Yeah, I guess it's a subtext of what Doug was talking
about. Right. Yeah, here, it's a good angle. So the Noahide is only on the real change of the real creation of another species, and that can only take place when you have the real objects in front of you, the tree or the animal.
Right.
Things that that have, right, and it, you could say, like, you know, why not plants? Evidently, you could say that things that have offspring, that's really where the problem is going to come in. Only that which has the possibility of a new species, and that can only take place when there's actually procreation of the species. So you need to have the objects there, the tree or the animal.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
If that's the case, then grafting would be a problem, because you're not genetically changing when you put an apple tree on top of whatever, you know, all the apple trees we have out there in the orchards these days and grapefruit, etc., they're not coming from seeds. They're all coming from grafting.
Right, but that's the solution.
It does. It genetically doesn't change that grapefruit. It doesn't genetically change that apple tree. But if you do crossbreeding, then you are getting a new species.
What do you define as crossbreeding?
You take an apple and a pear and you cross them to get an apple pear.
How do you cross
them?
Isn't it by putting a branch of one into the other tree, and now that branch is not drawing on the nutrients? If I take a tree and
that's not genetically changing anything. All that's doing is you're sapping energy off the other plant.
But isn't that going to produce?
Genetically doesn't change it. Genetically is at the breeding process. That's the only time you're going to get a genetic change.
So you're saying when you plant the seeds in the ground?
No, that doesn't change it either. You have two trees or two plants, let's say corn and squash. If the pollen from the corn goes over, you know, a little bug takes the corn and then the squash is right next to it and takes it down there and fertilizes it. You get a let's say you're able to get a corn squash. That is crossbreeding. A horse inseminating a mule is crossbreeding. The donkey, is crossbreeding.
Well, it seems to be that the Talmud is treating the crossbreeding of animals the same as grafting branches. So according to the Talmud, it would seem to be that putting a branch of one species into the trunk of another is going to crossbreed. Otherwise, they had no equation. So I think based on, you know,
what I'm dealing with is what the other people are saying is that what we're prohibited from doing is creating something new, genetically, creating something genetically new, and all I'm saying is that grafting does not genetically create something new. You're creating, what you're doing is you're getting a
Well, they must have felt there was enough of a refraction. I don't know if it's genetic. I mean, I don't know if they didn't have the science of genetics back then. So, according to them, this was a sufficient breach because you were now causing an apple to grow based on the sustenance of an orange, and that was no different than, you know, causing a horse to grow inside of a sheep or whatever it was. So, I mean, just for all, you know, argument's sake, it seems that the Gemara is definitely a grouping together, you know, grafting, whether it's genetic or not, with crossbreeding, with insemination of one species into another. But what we were saying earlier is good, that the real violation is in terms of creating the new species. But the areas which are more, like, for example, Ben Noach is not commanded to take off a garment of wool and linen if he's wearing it. There's no such possibility of any growth. These are things that are not attached to their nutritive sources anymore. The wool has been sheared off the sheep, and the linen, the flax, is not growing from the ground anymore. So there's no possibility of any type of crossbreed. But so therefore, that far, the Noahide is not commanded, but the Jew is. Meaning that far, a Jew has to go and has to address every single possibility where there is any connection. It's sort of like, you know, the rabbis have the right to make fences for the law. So they see that there's a a person is going to ride a horse on a Sabbath, really there's nothing wrong with it, but there's a prohibition of uprooting a plant. That's plowing. And even breaking a branch off of a tree would be a violation of plowing. So since when a person's riding a horse, he wants it to move, he may break a branch off the tree to whip the horse to move it. So they made a rabbinic law, do not ride the horse on the Sabbath, as a protection that you shouldn't come to break a branch off a tree. So you see that the rabbis have that right, but even the Torah itself works with that type of a thinking, where even though the wool and linen that I'm wearing on my garment can't crossbreed anymore, they're not growing anymore, nonetheless, the Torah does prohibit the Jew from wearing those two because he shouldn't even come close. Meaning this is such a violation that every aspect of crossbreeding is guarded against, even on a Torah level, even not even going to the rabbinic level.
But Rabbi, can I ask just a quick question? And I don't know if this has anything to do with it or not, but I was reading someplace one time where a person, I don't know if it was a Noahide who asked the question, but asked the question of a rabbi that, is it permissible for a Noahide to go into for instance, a church and sit there even though the people and the members of that church are worshiping, you know, let's say an idol or whatever anyone determines to be an idol? And the response from the rabbi was, while that is permissible for a Noahide, that is not permissible for a Jew.
Okay.
So is there any kind of linkage here between that and what we're discussing here? Because
yes.
It's very interesting that the four prohibitions that a Jew is prohibited in terms of mixing, while there are two out of the four the Noahide is permitted and the other two he's forbidden. I guess my question is what are the deeper distinctions as to why that is regarding the relationship between the Noahide and the Jew?
Right, because that goes back to the main distinction, as Rabbi Chait had stated, that the system of the Noahide is not a system of perfection. It's a minimal system that earns a human being the right to live. These are the minimal that have to be observed if a person wants to earn his right to life. If a person can't even keep these, then he's too far gone and he's killed, even for stealing a penny, because stealing is one of the Noahide laws. So even though a Jew is not killed for stealing a penny, but a Noahide is, why? Because the Jew has an entire system which is going to keep him intact. So, you know, the small infraction of stealing the penny is not something which is a descript of some sort of a real primary and base corruption in the person, because he's got so many laws that he's following. But if a Noahide only has 7 laws, for example, or whatever the actual number is, and he can't even keep those, that means it's a real, the stealing of the penny shows a tremendous corruption of the individual that deserves death, because he can't even keep these minimal. Right, the same philosophy would apply to a Jew that can't even keep those 7. Because again, you know, there's no hide in the Jew, there's no difference in our design. So the concept is, if we want to just, you know, elaborate a bit, is that the system of Noahide laws are the minimal system for a human being to live, but it doesn't mean that you should stop there. A person who follows the Torah and keeps the other commands is going to get the same perfection as a Jew, right? Because since we have the same design, we're going to gain the same benefits, same perfection.
But the remedy for the Noahide who steals a penny, for instance, I mean, the remedy is essentially that, you know, he has to do tshuva. I mean, he has to repent. He has to, you know, show remorse, correct?
Yeah, any person.
Yeah, so it's...
Any person that does something wrong has to. But he has to realize that if you can't just keep a minimal set, you know, such a small set that shows a real level of corruption that they just can't follow, recognize God as giving you a very small set of laws. This is the minimal. This is a starting point. It's not a system of perfection. But the reason why the Jew has to, in all areas of mixed breeding, he can't wear the wool and linen, even though a Noahide can. And he can't plant 2 seeds together, even though the Noahide can. Because the system of Torah is the opposite, so to speak, of what the Noahide system is. Noahide system is just the minimal amount of laws that earn a person's right to life. But the real target for a human being should try to perfect himself in every area possible. So that's what the Jew represents. He has a system of 613 thousands and thousands of rabbinic laws that he must keep his entire life. Why? Because this is where a person is going to achieve optimum perfection. If in every area he's not mixed breeding, I'm not going to wear the woolen linen. I'll remind myself over here that this is something which calls back, like Ebenezer says, that I shouldn't mix the two things in my heart. I should make all my decisions in life based on intelligence and not emotional, you know, knee-jerk responses or just chasing after my desires, because that'll just ruin me. But if I follow intelligence, that's how God designed the world, that is going to lead me to the best type of a lifestyle. Even though I may have emotional desires and something else may feel better, but if I have to fast, you know, a few days out of the year, that there's going to be a benefit to that, even though there's some discomfort, and it's minimal discomfort. But by doing so, I can recognize, I can reflect on myself, and while I'm fasting, I can think about what am I fasting about. There was those tragedies for the Jews, and they were sinning, and is there any sinning that I'm doing right now? I can use the day to reflect and see, is there anything which I'm doing right now which I can work on, to introspect and to admit error. And by not eating, I'm demonstrating a reliance on food which God creates. So it creates a stronger bond, a stronger reality that I am a dependent creature. I need the food of this Creator. So I'm not the great person that I imagined my whole life, and that great feeling of myself that hides all of my flaws. So there are a lot of benefits to, you know, a day of fasting. We have a fast this week. So, a Noachide benefit as well by going through the same process, because, again, there's no difference in design between a Noachide and a Jew. Again, one is just a minimal system in terms of perfection. You know, that's the other system. That's the system of the Jew, the Torah.
So the fast of the 17th of Tammuz, if a Noahide participates in the fast of the 17th of Tammuz, that is permitted?
Yes, it's permitted for Noahide to keep pretty much all the laws except for Sabbath, holidays, and the learning Torah outside of the areas that you're commanded in. But in terms of all the laws, the Maimonides says openly, if a Noahide wants to keep the other laws, and so... We don't stop him from doing it exactly as what the law says.
It's very interesting.
Yeah. The only thing that I would say about fasting is that if it's not a holiday, because that's one thing which Noahide can't do. But just to play it safe, if you decide to fast and you recognize, you know, you look at the history of what happened on the day. Here I have school that I attend, so that they send out a list. So there were five basic things, and it's brought down also in the Mishnah Berurah, which brings down the Torah law. So the first tablets that Moses got on Sinai, Moses broke on the 17th of Tammuz, and the daily sacrifices were suspended in the first temple era. And the third thing that happened, the third tragedy, was that the enemies penetrated the walls of Jerusalem before the destruction of the second temple. The fourth thing was the wicked king Apostomus burned the Torah. And the fifth was that the idol was erected in the temple. So because of these tragedies, so we have a fast day on Tuesday, the 17th of Tammuz. So in
reality, all of those events, those tragic events that happened in history, would apply to the Noahide. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, it wouldn't be an issue there.
Yeah, it is all one system. I mean, the Noahide is part of the whole 613. So it's not it's one. These things which are bad events should be recognized by Jew and Noahide equally, that they're the negative events. It's all one Torah, for sure.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Yeah. No problem. Right, so it seems so what we derive then from this part of the Talmud is that the Noahide only has to, you know, the real physical creation, like you were saying, Doug, that's only going to take place by the grafting of the tree branch and the actual, causing one animal to copulate with another. So, but in terms of the more fine points of not wearing wool and linen, since that's not going to cause any type of mixed breeding to take place, the Noahide is not commanded. But since a Jew is trying to uproot all false ideas and trying to address every single possible deviation, so then the Jew has to abide by those extreme cases, even though the Noahide doesn't. Because again, the Jew system is, and keep in mind that the rabbis talk about the fact that God offered the Torah to the other nations, and but it was rejected, which means to say that the system of Torah really is applicable to all human beings. So that's what that medrash is. That's what that the allegory is. Okay. All right. All right. Any questions? All right. So Miodus will end over here. This pretty much wraps up this part of the Talmud. And we'll see. I'll look through and see what we'll pick up as we. The next area we basically addressed last week. We went a little bit in reverse. So what I'll do is, I guess during the week, I'll try to give you a heads up in terms of what the topic will be for a week from today. And we'll continue in this area in the Talmud Sanhedrin. I'm just looking here as I'm speaking to you. All right, let me give you a look over. And Doug or Cal, I'll pop an email to you during the week, and we'll see what we'll take up. If there's any questions that you have as well, feel free. If there's something that is specific.
Will do.
What's that?
I've been reading the Jewish Times, like I'm sure a lot of other people obviously do. Is there any possible way that somebody could do like a Noahide Corner article in Jewish Times that would deal specifically with Noahide issues in addition to everything else that you're doing with regard to the Jewish Times?
Yeah, I guess if there's specific issues, because I guess that would be what we're doing here on Sunday is addressing that. So the question is whether there's enough time to do both.
Yeah.
Here is more, it may be more beneficial here because it's interactive. You can, if you have questions, you can hear them right there on the spot.
Oh.
It's more fluid, and it's just the
and
time.
Thinking that some of the information you're sharing might reach a wider audience if it was put into print. Someplace in the Jewish Times. What's the readership of Jewish Times? It's several thousand people, correct?
Yeah, it's a few thousand people, right.
So, based on, our discussions on Sunday morning, there's, a few of us. It might, might be helpful to...
Yeah, it definitely would be. It's a time factor. It's just the amount of time to...
I'm a little embarrassed to ask that because I know you're 24
it's,
hours.
It's nice of you to volunteer at the time.
just a thought for the day.
I would love to do it. If there's a possibility to do that, and then I want to do it right if I would do something like that. And the truth is, a lot of times, based on the discussions that we have, that does form. Some of the content, even though it's not titled that way, but there may be like a paragraph here and there, or there may be an article itself, which is really
you know, something which is an outgrowth of what we do on Sunday.
It might expose more people to the whole concept of the Noahide idea, since so few people have even the basic minimal understanding of what it even is.
Right. Well, there was about a month ago, you know, I wrote specifically about the difference between you know, the false conception and the true conception, that there is no difference between a Jew and Gentile. You know, just a very primary article, actually. I think I mentioned too that the Jewish press had run it about 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, and it was nice to hear that they were, you know, just having a casual conversation with somebody there, and he appreciated the sentiment which he, you know, subscribed to, that there is no difference between Jew and Gentile, even though, you know, a lot of Jews may have this feeling of a Jewish superior soul. So, you know, what you're suggesting is something that's, you know, we are doing.
Yeah, you know, along those lines, Rabbi, I just so much appreciate what you're doing in that regard, because I know that you're probably getting a lot of blowback in that area.
Well, it's funny. I thought there'd be a lot more harsh, you know, response from the right-wing Jewish corner, but the responses that I saw to that were really, you know, just a few of them. One was very supportive, and then three people wrote in with, you know, pretty much their own idiosyncratic, you know, view. A Jew is superior. You know, of course they have no source, and it's just their own egos that are blowing wind. And, you know, but I gave the sources clearly. I mean, and the corruptions that exist in some, you know, current texts that try to, you know, claim that there's a superior Jewish soul. All this is based on real, you know, illiteracy, real corruptions of texts. And the Torah itself is completely against that. But people don't work that way. They follow their lives, you know, Jew and non-Jew, like they're following the masses, and they don't stop and think for themselves to say, hey, let me look at the sources, let me see exactly what God said or not. So, you know, in that respect, so, you know, your suggestion is a good suggestion, that people should be more aware of this. Just to take on another formal thing, I don't want to, you know, oblige myself to something which I can't do on a regular basis, so. But, you know, it's definitely something in the forefront, and that's which, you know, a lot of my studies during the week personally is on this now, because I'm interested myself in seeing what, you know, how God's plan was originally, and for Adam, and then for Noah, and how, you know, how with the unfolding of history, what different changes God had implemented, why the Torah wasn't given right at the outset to Adam, and why Noah only had seven. So this is the area that we're discussing, so it gives us an appreciation. We really can't know, you know, without God saying something clearly, what a theory is, but, you know, we can suggest possibilities. And that's why I was suggesting that in terms of the Talmud that comes next, which we did last week, that talks about how Adam only had one command. It's amazing. Why does Adam have one command and we have, you know, 613? And my suggestion was that, again, you can't say it with any surety, but God created Adam, an individual. He didn't create the Jew and non-Jew. He just created man and women. And he gave us intelligence and wanted us to live our life based on what we can derive from our intelligence. And this basically is what Avram was. I remember Rabbi Chait once responding to somebody that you really need the Torah to, you know, to perfect yourself. Can't you, you know, look at Abraham? So Rabbi Chait's response is, yeah, but how many Abrahams are there? You know, you have one one in the entire existence of man, one or two. So you see, the Torah is necessary from 99.9999, you know, repeating decimal over there. Population requires it.
It's hard to take one example of one of the highest forms of perfection and then apply it to everybody else, you know, and say it's, you know, it's for you too. Well, I just want to encourage you, what you're doing with the Jewish Times. I really enjoyed the articles.
Oh, thanks a lot. It's nice to hear.
Yeah, very well researched, very well documented, and, you know, your arguments are, you know, very profound.
Thank you. I hope to see you.
What you believe and are teaching are very profound.
Thank you. Yeah, I hope they reach more people, and that, I mean, a lot of times these arguments have to be repeated over and over again because they go against the grain. But, like this week was about conservative and reform Judaism. So that was the cover article was about that. Because that's another, you know, big problem. You know, you have all different parts of the spectrum. You have Noahide, you have
the right wing, you have problems in Hasidism, you have problems with the Babich, and the other, and you have problems with the conservative reform, and then you get problems with the, you know, mainstream Orthodox also. So there are a lot of issues to be addressed, but here this week I wanted to address, you know, just primarily what, you know, the basic problems were, and you know, how it applies to a person trying to just picking and choosing, because that's really what conservative and reform are doing. You know, it's just a few hundred years old, those two, you know, forms of quote-unquote Judaism. You know, before that, you didn't have any, none of the rabbis, none of the greats like Rashi and Maimonides and, you know, in the Talmud, these great, brilliant geniuses, not one ever suggested what conservative, you know, what conservative reform suggests. So it's an amazing thing. Now, all of a sudden, a few hundred years ago, and you see the reasoning. I found quotes as to why these movements started. Oh, they wanted to dress like the, you know, the they wanted to taper things down. We don't think that the law is divine. Well, let's see your proof. I mean, it's just their own subjective feelings. And because of that, they start a new thing. Oh, we want to have more, you know, the conservative movements based on this theory that, you know, the law is fluid and it changes with the times. Well, why doesn't anybody who's of a more brilliant mind say that? Why didn't Maimonides say that? All the greatest transmitters of Torah never held these type of views. Where are the people in the conservative and the reform camp that have written the volumes and the depth of writing, as Rabbi Hirsch and Maimonides and Rashi and Ibn Ezra? They don't have anybody like that, and yet they feel superior. I mean, it's a real arrogance. But the underpinnings of the conservative and reform movement are alive and well in many people today. You know, it's really just a picking and choosing. I know better, so I gave the analogy about, you know, people wouldn't do that with the bodies. If a doctor tells you you have to, you know, take this pill and that pill and this other pill, you know, three times a day, and you'll live to be 100 years old, you'll have a very healthy life. A person would be foolish to say, well, I'm not going to take that pill because I don't like the color. I'm not going to take this pill because I don't like the flavor. A person would never do that. And the reasoning is because a person has such a great priority he places on his physical life. But that really, at the same time, exposes how a person deprecates his soul. He doesn't look at the soul with the same level of value. And he'll pick and choose in the Torah system and convert it to a reformed or a conservative movement, and he'll do all this not recognizing that he is akin to a person who rejects the medication from a doctor. Now, a doctor has limited knowledge, but when you're talking about God's Torah, he knows absolutely what you need. And for there, if you're going to now start pick and choose based on your own subjective, you know, daily wishes, my agenda, oh, I want to have a Saturday to go shopping, you know, the excuses you hear are just mind-boggling. How superficial, and how the person is just, people just do not give any value to their soul. And you can't deny the fact that everybody dies, so how do they do this? It's just an amazing thing. But, you know, conservative reform definitely show you how people are able to do this in mass, not just individuals. Something that's very appealing emotionally. Oh, I can get rid of some of the laws now. We can be fluid. We can drive to a synagogue in the South. And, you know, we can, well, the Torah is not really divine, so that gives me an out from half the laws that, you know, I just don't like. So, these are across the board. These aren't just Jewish issues. This is a human issue. So I hope people, you know, Noahites as well, benefit from this type of appreciation.
Well, you know, I have a friend who's a conservative rabbi, and he has on both sides of his family, he has some that are like ultra-Orthodox, and then he has some that are Reformed. He himself was, bar mitzvah in a Reformed synagogue. I think the origins of this back in the 18th century, doesn't this have more to do with the idea that, you know, people want to, they think that by assimilating and becoming more like everybody else around them, that there'll be less anti-Semitism, there'll be less anger against the Jewish people. That really hasn't proven to be the case. I mean, Reform Judaism and Conservative Judaism haven't experienced any less anti-Semitism than any other group.
Yeah, it's just the opposite.
It invites
anti-Semitism. That was Rabbi Chait gave a class on when Jacob first met Esav after all those years, and, you know, Jacob had rightfully purchased the birthright, but, you know, Esav always felt undermined.
So Jacob always felt that at a certain point, Esav is going to try to kill him. At a certain point in time, Jacob found out that Esav was approaching him with 400 men. So he was terrified for his life, for his family. He split his camp into two camps. He prepared militarily. He prayed to God. So he prepared spiritually. And he also prepared, you know, politically by sending, you know, lots of animals as a gift. And when he finally approaches him, Jacob says to Esav, and Esav actually was very moved, and some say he genuinely, you know, was moved internally, and he cried, whatever. But why did Jacob say to Esav that he was dwelling with Laban this whole time, and he kept the entire system of Torah, whatever he had, he kept the entire system from the patriarchs that came before him, and he didn't veer? What would Esav care? Esav was a hunter. He was an idolater. What would it matter to Esav, his evil twin brother, that Jacob would tell him that I kept everything properly? So Rabbi Chaya explained that this is really where the underpinnings of anti-Semitism come from. It's when the Jew violates, that's when other people can have grounds to attack him. And that's what the problem is with Jews today, being apologetic and trying to engage in, you know, interfaith dialogue. I mean, we are not interested in the opinions of idolatrous cultures. We don't need to be taught about our Torah either. And to engage in discussion, it completely would give the impression that there is something that other nations can tell us about Torah, which is ridiculous. But the Jew wants to really combat anti-Semitism. That's what Jacob was saying. He said, there was no grounds for you to have any aggression towards me. I did not do anything. I kept what I was supposed to keep. I've been living properly. So he was basically pulling the carpet out from under Esav in terms of any way that he can be aggressive towards him. So that's really what the Jew should do. Is the Jew should be proud and should be living the Torah properly, because if he does, so first of all, he's going to give the correct impression to the other nations. And what God says in the Torah, that the other nations will look at the Jews when they follow the commands, and they'll say, what a wise and understanding people this is. The other nations will be impressed, because this is God's wisdom. So the only way that we can impress them and they can really respect the Torah is if we keep it, and we don't compromise with interfaith dialogue, and we don't make apologies for living a certain way, or wearing tzitzis or tefillin. And in fact, what we do is we explain the beauty and the precision behind each one of these laws. Other people see this, they will admit it as well, because we all work with reasoning. Every human being has the capacity to see, you know, a rational argument behind something.
Well, isn't that the whole story behind Parshat Balak? This is, you know, the whole idea behind Balaam and, you know, trying to, you know, curse the Jewish people, and he had no grounds to curse the Jewish people. So, you know, the only alternative for Balaam was to try to get the Jewish people to curse themselves, you know, by doing crazy things, you know, immorality, that sort of thing. But
yeah, it's interesting.
When the Jews were doing, when the Jews were doing everything they were supposed to be doing, you know, he had, you know, there was no grounds for cursing.
Right.
I never understood the whole interfaith dialogue thing.
Yeah, that's a problem.
It's a fruitless exercise.
Yeah, well, listen, we ran something on that in the Jewish Times, too. I'm not sure which issue it was. It was a while back. Maybe a year and a half ago. But, you know, we're not pulling any punches. And if something is a problem that goes against the system, you know, it has to be discussed. And, you know, people today, they have this, you know, you know, I hear both sides. Like sometimes we get accused for being too direct, aggressive in your positions in terms of how you present something. On the other hand, when you just put things delicately and lightly, you know, you're being like apologetic, and you're not showing how much you really care about what you're speaking about. So, you know, I see both sides, and you know, if a person is not attacking you, so then there's no reason to be aggressive. You speak nicely, pleasantly. Divrei Torah benachas nichnas. It's a statement of the rabbis. They say that the words of the Torah, they penetrate somebody when they're delivered in a very gentle manner. And you show concern for the person and so on. But if you're like on the short, if you're getting the short end of the stick, so it also says in the Haggadah that there's four sons that
the Haggadah talks about, and one of them is the wicked son. So the response he's supposed to do to him is to be harsh, like to blunt his teeth. You don't, you know, speak with an apologetic tone. You don't, you know, somebody's harsh, you respond that way. And the rabbi said it as well, that any Talmud Chacham, any wise person who doesn't take revenge like a viper, like a snake, so he's not a real wise person. Meaning, he doesn't take revenge out of an emotional response, because that's something which a wise person is in control of. He's in control of all his emotions. But he has to demonstrate an intolerance when he sees people attacking that are, brazenly aggressive and maybe without cause, unprovoked. So then the response has to be harsh. You don't lie down and take it. So again, it depends on who you're responding to, the idea you're trying to get across. But I don't think passion should be hidden. I don't think that. A friend of mine was telling me, maybe you know Rabbi Saul Zucker. He was telling me how he had a dialogue for over a number of weeks with somebody. And this was like in the Chabad camp, and they were emailing back and forth. And he told me how he finally made headway with him because he was very, you know, polite and calm and so on through the whole thing. And he said if he would have been aggressive, he would have, you know, said, oh, you don't like me because I'm Chabad, and that's it. And then the whole dialogue would have ended. So I agree with the way that he did there. But again, each case has to be assessed in terms of how you approach it and the points to get across.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Now I agree with you on the there's nothing that the idolatrous nations can teach, you know, Jews about the Torah. My question is there a place for Jews with other groups to try to combine on social agendas that they might agree on? A format, or is it even worth trying?
Give me an example.
Oh, maybe gay marriage, abortion, maybe some issues like that where they might agree that those aren't good and work on legislation to dealing with those.
I don't know where the cross would be in terms of politics, but I mean the first rule is that the truths can never be compromised on, and then the question is in what forms to discuss them. They should always be discussed in terms of a religious, you know, religious forum. I mean, if a person wants to try to help legislation understand that, you know, there's a big problem. Legislation has this thing of separation between church and state. Now you're going to bring an argument in about morality. You can't say whether or not, you know, at what point is an embryo considered life or not just by, you know, a personal subjective view. This has to be determined by only one being, I mean, God, who created life. So, but then once you bring God into the picture, now all, you know, legislative doors will be shut because now you're bringing, you're crossing the line between church and state. So you have problems over there. But if a person has the ability to educate people in any forum, he should do it. If he has the truth and the people are willing to listen, you know, that's another thing also. You don't want to waste time.
Please note that your conference will expire in 10 minutes.
So, yeah, definitely the person should, bring it up. Then you have other issues, though, in terms of should you have a forum where it's like, you know, like interfaith is like you're saying you're coming to the table, you know, the Orthodox Jew and the Catholic bishop. So that should not, you know, that shouldn't take place. I think Yosef Soloveitchik wrote about this, and that was a big problem for this yeshiva in Manhattan that had bishops, a Chovevei Torah, some yeshiva in the city, a higher yeshiva. These yeshivas ordaining rabbis under the Orthodox title, but yet they're, you know, they're having open discussions and inviting bishops to come down, and, you know, which is sending the wrong message. So it depends on the group. You really have to, it has to be a case by case, you know, study. But the rule is, if you can teach, should do it. The more you can teach, the better. And But the form, you know, is important because that's going to send a message too. All right?
Yes. Well, thank you, Rabbi, for spending some extra time with us today.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
My pleasure. All right, so I'll try to see what we'll pick up next week on. I actually was interested in the whole thing about Balak, so I think I'll look through that. It's interesting why there were three prophecies, and then there was a fourth that Bilaam, I think, originated on his own. You know, what were the three messages that God was giving to Balak? So maybe what we'll do is we'll take a look at that during the week if you'd like to do that, since you brought it up.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, Rabbi. Well, listen, have an easy path.
Thank you so much. Have a great week to everybody.
Thanks, Rabbi. I appreciate it. You have a great week, too.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, that ends today's class. We'll continue next week, same time, 11:15, Sunday. It'll be July 8th. Until then, everybody, have a great week.